Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Well, hello everyone from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network that we call Blog Talk Radio. A big hello to everyone around the world. We have a fantastic show planned tonight. Joining us in just a little bit, author, poet, naturalist Robert Michael Pyle will be talking to us from butterflies to Bigfoot. Ought to be a great hour, so we hope you've got a nice cold or warm beverage, a comfortable seat, and enjoy our program tonight. As always, handling the technical responsibilities, Melissa Hovey and the studio producer Wayne Larson. Music done by Jim Johnson, and from the massive Wild World News Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Well, good evening, Mr. Batson.
I made a boo-boo already. Melissa Hovey is our studio producer.
That's
Wayne
right.
Wayne Larson is a technical engineer.
That's right.
That means I'd have to pay them equal if I didn't correct that mistake. So how are we doing, Dr. Day?
Good, good, good. We got through the Super Bowl. Everything went well.
It did go well. The only thing that didn't go well is our last week's guest didn't predict the winner correctly.
But, that's right.
Mark Chesna with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, North America's greatest sports fan. But I think like a lot of people, except those living in New England, are quite thrilled with the outcome. What a great game that was.
It was. It was what we were hoping for.
It certainly was. The following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the new children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson. Order your autographed copy today at www.larrytheanimalguy.com or send check or money order for $10 per copy to, sharpen that pencil, WES 4140 North, 600 West, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. And as always, shipping and handling is included.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News for February the 9th. Now, according to a survey, the sales of antacids and aspirins increased by 20% on Monday, the day after the Super Bowl. Interesting.
There's some fact-finding for you.
Now, before we head off to Anchorage, Alaska tonight, here's an interesting fact. Alaska has the highest percentage of people who walk to work.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought that.
Nor I.
Awesome. Crap.
All right, Anchorage, Alaska. Feeding moose is normally taboo, but wildlife officials will make an exception this year because of the deep snow. And as we know, they've had up to 15 foot of snow in some areas there already. Now, the Department of Fish and Game issued a permit to the Alaskan Moose Federation, allowing it to take measures to divert moose from roads, driveways, and railways, which moose seek out in the heavy snow, because it's easy passage.
Right.
Now, the measure includes feeding stations and trails that moose can use to move to their natural feeding areas.
Well, good for them.
Yeah, and you don't normally you want to get that close enough to a moose to feed one.
No, you don't.
This year we're making an exception.
I guess so.
All right, now it's turning out to be a good year for bird watchers.
Oh.
As we've reported the snowy owls over the last few months. Well, Peru, New York, three tundra swans from the Arctic are drawing bird watchers to Assabule Point State Park on Lake Champlain. Now, two adults and a juvenile have established a presence just offshore, likely drawn there by the mild winter and the fact that the lake isn't frozen over. But wait, we're not done watching birds yet.
Oh.
Paris, California. An Arctic bird that has never been seen, reported, has never been reported in the Southern California area, has taken up residence near Lake Paris. Now, drawing bird watchers, hoping to catch a glimpse of the world's largest falcon.
Really?
Now, the taupe and white gear falcon was spotted at the wildlife area on June 15th.
Hmm.
So, it's going to be an interesting, as we talked about before the show, the birds are getting together early this year.
Yes, things are. We have flowers in our yard that have never lost their blooms all winter. So, it's been strange.
All right, well, what's the big news at the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle, Washington? I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Now, listen to this. The two girls climbed on the scale, and their total poundage was unbelievable. But nobody was really upset. In fact, one woman who came within a pound of correctly guessing the combined weight of Woodland Park Zoo's hippos was Elaine Michaels, who guessed 6,280 pounds.
Really?
That's two hippos. Now, Guadalupe and Water Lily totaled 6,279 pounds.
Man.
Now, Elaine gets to meet the hippos behind the scenes.
Yeah.
She also gets zoo passes and a four-gallon bucket of Zoodoo fertilizer.
Wow, they really went all out putting prizes together for that.
Pretty nice.
She doesn't even get a stupid T-shirt or anything like that.
Oh, they might be able to work one in for her.
Okay.
That's a lot of hippo.
That's a lot of hippo.
All right, here's one for our studio producer, Melissa Huffy.
Oh.
Gainesboro, Florida. Now, we know Melissa loves sharks. Now, shark attacks declined in the U.S. last year, but worldwide fatalities reached a two-decade high, which doesn't quite make any sense, but according to the University of Florida's International Shark Attacks file. Now, a total of 75 attacks were reported worldwide, which is close to the decade average, and Florida had 11 of the nation's 29 attacks.
Where in the world did they say were the sharks the hungriest?
Well, we don't have that information, but I'd say somewhere where there's a lot of bathers.
Yeah. I was wondering if it might be Australia, you know, great whites live off the coast of Australia. That's interesting.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll do a little more research on that.
Yeah, put your team on that, Dr.
All right, now, people in Maryland will be happy to know that the stink bug numbers are down.
Oh.
Yeah, now, all right, off to Billings, Montana. Now, listen to this. As you have a couple of very large bears in your backyard, visitors to the Zoo Montana will get a better idea of how grizzly bears interact, since two male grizzlies can be in the bear exhibit at the same time now. Two male grizzlies. Bruno and Ozzy were introduced last week. And they first they stared at each other, nuzzled, and Ozzy rolled on his back. Bruno then sat on him for about an hour, and then they started wrestling.
I'm not even going to go there. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We may know why the bears get along so well.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, we'll just leave that one as it is.
As it is, that's right.
All right, now, I think we better start adopting iguanas.
Oh, my.
Because, listen to this story. U.S. territory, Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
The island's government announced plans to kill as many iguanas as possible and export their meat in hopes of eradicating an imported species that has long vexed the residents and entertained tourists. Now, Puerto Rico has roughly 4 million iguanas, and they're not native to the islands.
Well, have the iguanas created a problem? I heard the word entertain tourists, and they want as many tourists as possible.
But, you know, as we know, since they're an invasive species there, they're destroying all of the ground life, the birds. All that stuff. So it sounds pretty drastic. So if you guys can help save some of these iguanas, they've got 4 million of them, so there's enough to go around.
Gosh. Well, Wayne Larson probably be good for one.
I think so. And with Valentine's Day coming up.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah.
What everybody needs.
Melissa would love a couple iguanas,
yeah.
I bet.
I'm just kidding, by the way.
Now, okay, well, since we're talking Valentine's Day, about 3% of pet owners will give Valentine's Day gifts to their pets.
Well, that's, you know, that's wonderful.
Now,
I'm sure.
Do you have something special planned for the tigers?
No, but I am sure our baby olive baboon Elizabeth will get some sort of memento from Valentine's Day.
Well, that's right. And she just had a birthday, didn't she?
She just celebrated her third birthday, enjoyed cupcakes and a variety of toys, a new basketball, a new bed to sleep in. Oh, yeah. It was quite a day.
All right.
Oh,
now,
and she ate the candles on the cake.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I do too, so. All right. Now, before we end the wild world news tonight, do you know what we were doing 48 years ago tonight?
I know. We were watching Ed Sullivan.
That's right.
As the Beatles made their world, or I should say their premiere to the United States.
That's right. Their first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight, 48 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. that's enough about that. Well,
that's really,
that
I
makes
feel
us
really
old.
Old.
All right, well, that's a wild world news for February the 9th.
Well, once again, a fine job done by our honorable distinguished guest, Dr. Henry Day, with the Wild World News. We want to tell everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our brand new Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos and information about our animal family, also RadioMom.fm, and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70%. On vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And tell you what, why not listen to my show, 12 to 7, the 70s on Sunday, at RadioMom.fm. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. I saw pictures from that area this week. It's snow-covered and beautiful. We call it God's Country. Go to their website at info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
Mother Nature.
Son, friend of the show, author, poet, probably one of the foremost authorities on butterflies in the world, our good friend Robert Michael Pyle joins us tonight. Good evening, Robert.
Good evening, Larry. I'm happy to be here. I was happy to hear Dr. Henry Day again.
Oh, I'll tell you what, he's an amazing man.
He surely is that. And I have a hypothesis on that interesting fact that he gave about Alaska having more people commuting to work by foot than anywhere
mm-hmm.
else. Well, walking's the only way you can run a trap line.
You know, I had not thought about that. But,
yeah. Could be the answer.
Gosh, you've been up to so much since the last time we've had a chance to chat with you. What's been going on in your life here lately?
Well, you know, I wrapped up that butterfly big year and came out with the book Mariposa Road about that. I spent the entire year out in the field all over the country trying to find as many different kinds of butterflies as I could,
mm-hmm.
which was a pretext for two things. One was a heck of a good field trip. The other thing was trying to get a handle on the condition of our butterflies all over the country at this day and age, with the climate changing out from under them and development proceeding apace. And, you know, keeping my eyes to the ground, for butterflies, my ears to the ground about Bigfoot while I was on the road. But it made for a wonderful, I would say, transect of butterfly habitats, but also a kind of a panorama, that's the word I'm looking for,
mm-hmm.
of the American landscape in a way that I've never been able to undertake before, to see so much of the country in 1 year. I traveled some 86,000 miles, 33,000 of that I drove in my ancient car, Powder Milk, the Honda, which now has 405,000 miles on it. And I walked every day. I was in the field every day. I actually got fit for a while.
Wow.
And to see this grand landscape, Larry, that houses and feeds the wildlife that you speak of on your show every time,
mm-hmm.
In such a panoramic fashion, that was a great privilege for me to be able to undertake. And I learned a lot, too, while I was at it.
What was there a particular area that you found especially appealing? Or
you'll be surprised to hear this, perhaps. I spent a lot of wonderful time in Alaska up in the high Arctic and the North Slope.
Mm-hmm.
I spent time near the great Kokie and Alakai swamp wildlands on Kauai, deep in the Everglades and the Keys, up to 13,500 feet in the San Juan Mountains of Colorado. Lots of other wild, wonderful places, but one of the most spectacular and rewarding areas that I spent time in, as far as the butterflies went, and landscapes in general, was Illinois.
Oh, my.
I didn't get much time in Indiana because of bad weather when I was going to go there, but
mm-hmm.
Illinois, of all places, proved to still have, and you wouldn't guess this from the vast expanses of BT corn and soybeans but you wouldn't guess it, but there are some absolutely wonderful nature reserves where there are remnants of the grand swamp that used to occupy the entire eastern flank of Illinois, and some hilltop sand prairies, and other places that really gave me a sense of what the country might have been like a long time ago, even before the Beatles broadcast on Ed Sullivan.
Oh, well. You know, Illinois is, there are some particular areas that are spectacular and wilderness.
And that's the
areas.
Case in Indiana and Iowa, too. I mean, people don't realize this. They tend to put down these heartland states as if they are entirely and completely modified.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, to a large degree they are, because they have been breadbasket. They've settled early and settle often. But the fact is that they also have dedicated conservationists. There's such a thing as the Illinois Natural History Survey, that wonderful old 19th century term. That still exists. It's the last state with a Natural History Survey. Other states have natural heritage programs and things like that. But Illinois kept the name. They've still got the Natural History Survey now. Isn't that wonderful? And that reflects itself on the ground.
Well, I wish I was fully aware that you're on this tour. I would have invited you to my my wilderness here at our animal compound, because I'll tell you what, in the summertime, the butterflies are extraordinary.
I should have come. I absolutely should have. You could have had your own chapter in the book.
Oh, that would have been fantastic. It's.
I'll do it at some time. I promise you that.
So what's your thoughts after this journey that you went on this summer about the state of, the population of butterflies, but basically the state of our natural world?
And that was it, really, because, as I say, it was a great field trip. It was a chance to write, I hope, an intriguing narrative of a road trip book. But it was also this transect of how habitats are doing, butterfly habitats in particular. But, of course, butterflies, because they more or less abstract the data, if you will, from all the plants, because they're plant-dependent, become good indicators and windows on the state of the world in general. Well, it was up and down. I mean, in 40 years of work in butterfly conservation, I would have been a fool to expect things to be great, because, of course, if they were great, we wouldn't have any work to do in butterfly conservation. The Xerces Society, named for the extinct Xerces blue butterfly, is the International Butterfly and Invertebrate Conservation Group. They just had their 40th birthday.
Wow.
Five states and 20 staff now, and they've never been busier. Of course, it's a huge job to try to conserve the small-scale wildlife on Earth. So clearly, there are a great many challenges. And in fact, I did notice a lot of decline of habitats, a lot of changing of ranges, both from development and from pesticides, the spread of the genetically modified crops, in particular the BT corn and the Roundup Ready soy, have caused what was generally a mosaic of a landscape with a lot of productive agriculture, but a lot of inoffensive food plants growing around the edges, to become much more homogenized in certain areas to the enrichment of a certain company that begins with Mon and ends in Santa. And so we expected that. And then there actually are significant changes in ranges that we can observe due to habitat change, of course, but due to climate change as well. There are butterflies that we visited in the high mountains that are being pushed off the tops of those mountains. On my 61st birthday, I'm happy to report, Larry, that I was physically able. Of course, mind you, I'd been in the field all year and I was dropped about 30 pounds and I was in reasonable shape. I was able to hike from 8,500 feet elevation to 13.5 with my friend Scott Black, who's the director of the Xerces Society, much younger and fitter than I am. But I made it without, he didn't have to carry me down, thank goodness.
Well, there you go.
We got up to the habitat of a butterfly called the Uncompahgre fritillary. It's one of the rarest butterflies in the world. It only occurs on about 10 or 12 peaks in the high San Juan Mountains above 13,000 feet, where its caterpillars feed on a prostrate kind of willow called the snow willow, and contend with sheep grazing on the national forests, and contend with other kinds of changes. But their primary contention right now is with climate change. As things get warmer, that butterfly has to retreat farther and farther up the mountain, and there's not that much farther to go. So between those kinds of things, habitat, climate, There's no question that there's a lot of retreat of wildlife. But as you know from many of the great conservation stories you report on, there are other places where people are discovering through careful inquisition and just plain good natural history fieldwork what these species need, and they are applying the best of our knowledge on the ground to try to bring them back. And not only that, but to keep the world hospitable
mm-hmm.
for a wide array of our natural butterfly heritage. That then redounds to the benefit of the plants, the other invertebrates, and they, of course, promote the birds. So I saw a lot to be happy about, too. By no means did it come away sanguine that everything is hunky-dory.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a foolish position to take in this day and age. But on the other hand, I wasn't quite as down about it at the end as I thought I might be. Kind of like at the end of my Bigfoot book, you know, Larry. I wondered if I might not come out of that thinking it was a great story, but that's all it was. And then, as you know, I came out of that book with my mind being wider open than it ever was, and it's even more wide open now, which we can talk about later. But that's what you want out of a book. When you're a writer,
mm-hmm.
you want a book to surprise you, because if it doesn't surprise you, it's never going to surprise your readers. And so I'm thrilled when I finish up a big field project and the book that comes out of it, when I come out with my mind expanded, you know, I let out the seams of my mindset, and the world's a little different place than when I began.
Well, it is, and you put it so well. Was there a particular area that was especially vibrant with wildlife?
Well, like I say, those marvelous reserves in eastern Illinois, where all the fritillaries, the great spangled fritillaries, were throbbing.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the national forests in Kentucky, where the Diana fritillaries, the big blue females that mimic the pipevine swallowtails, and the big jack-o'-lantern orange and black males were flying these butterflies that were at the other end of the state. In eastern Kentucky, I watched the mountaintop removal coal mining, which is gobbling the habitat of those butterflies by the acre, by the minute, you know. So to see other places where they're protected and thriving is salutary. I would say, too, that some of the canyons in the Rockies front in Montana
mm-hmm.
were particularly vibrant with butterflies. The High Sierra up
uh-huh.
at Tioga Pass in Yosemite National Park, I got there at just the right time when the snow was melting and the endemic butterflies were popping out. I had a lot of good luck. Now, mind you, that was after 3 months at the beginning where the weather was absolutely foul on the West Coast with a La Nina year and lots of rain and driving wind off the sea. I almost was blown over a couple of times. And at the end of my first 6 weeks on the butterfly big year, I had tallied all of 8 species.
Oh, my.
So my luck was not always good. And I had a great many encounters with law enforcement. They kept wondering, what in the world was I doing? Who was this guy out here in strange places? And in a few cases, I was inadvertently actually trespassing, I guess. And there was a big, tall, handsome Texas Ranger in a beautiful uniform and just a well cared for individual and polite as could be, and he came up and he said, sir, you're welcome to all the butterflies in Texas. We just wish you'd do it over here on the other side of that there fence. My
well,
favorite law enforcement encounter, however, took place in Illinois. In Louisiana. I'd come down the Mississippi Delta. I'd been in eastern Tennessee in April. It was just beautiful on the Tennessee River, and I found some riverbank terraces on the Tennessee River that were brilliant green and white with the spring wildflowers and vegetation, and two butterflies I'd wanted to see all my life, the falcate orange tip and the rare West Virginia white butterfly floating like little scraps of linen through that spring landscape. Couldn't have been prettier. And then I drove all night that night to get to Memphis to go to Graceland. I'd written an essay, a lot of essays in a particular magazine. Another woman who wrote in that magazine wrote a piece about rural attitudes about the city and vice versa, which, as you know, is something we have to attend to.
Mm-hmm.
And this article was called One Country Under Elvis.
Oh.
So I promised her that I would put a copy of the magazine, Orion Magazine, on Elvis's tomb when I was in the area. So I had to go to Graceland.
Oh,
so I'm traveling across the middle of Louisiana in the middle of the night, and I come to an armadillo. And as you know, armadillos are diligent in their efforts to help with the road paving projects in the South.
Yes, right. Yeah.
It's a sad thing. So here was a live armadillo that had not been hit, Mirabile dictu. And so I stopped and got out and moved the armadillo off the road, and a state trooper stopped. And he said, are you lost, sir? And I said, no, sir, officer, I'm going to Graceland. Well, that's the best thing you can possibly say to any person in Tennessee. So he said, oh, well, that's wonderful. I'm so glad you're going to Graceland. He said, good traveling there to you, sir. But he said, don't worry about those. We got plenty of them. Talking about the Costello. And then the next day I'd gone all the way down the Mississippi Delta after Graceland.
Mm-hmm.
And got down to Vicksburg. The day after that, I was driving into Louisiana. It had been a cloudy morning, but the clouds cleared and sun came out, and the roadside verge was just absolutely throbbing with swallowtails and little blues and crescent spots and all sorts of wonderful butterflies. And I was having a good time. I was having a big time. And I went back to my car, and here was a sheriff's deputy waiting for me. I wasn't even trespassing. He just didn't know what I was doing up there. That butterfly net. And he said, what's going on here? So I gave him my business card for the Xerxes Society.
Mm-hmm.
That told all about, on the back of it, told all about the butterfly big ear and everything I was doing. Saved a lot of time in encounters like that. And I added it to him. It's spelled X-E-R-C-E-S, Xerxes. And he turned it over in his hand, looked it up and down, right and left. And he looked back up at me and he said, so, you belong to this here Exorcist Society? I said, thank you, sir. You can't buy language like that for your book. So I had a lot of fun out there encountering the good people of the American landscape as well as the butterflies.
Our guest tonight, Robert Michael Pyle. We're going to take a short break. This show's not long enough tonight. We'll be back in just a few moments. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We will be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny! Playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling.
What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
It's Bobcat, Abby. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean?
Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com. Only you
can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this worldwide wonderful network we call Blog Talk Radio. We are going to be back in just a few moments with Robert Michael Pyle talking butterflies to Bigfoot. Fantastic show already, so we just can't wait to dive in and talk to Robert about his summer adventures. That'll be happening in just a moment. We want to tell everyone, though, the first annual Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Expo will be happening May 6th in Maysville, New York, at the Chautauqua Suites. What a great day we have planned. Speakers Melissa Hovey and Steve Calls from the Discovery Channel, Monster Quest, Billy Willard, and yours truly will be speaking, and we hope everyone in that area will have an opportunity to attend. Here's the phone number for more information and maybe make reservations for that day, 716-789-3383, or just Google Chautauqua Lake Bigfoot Expo, and you'll find all the information about a great day we have planned on May the 6th. Also, a big thank you to the Icebox, an affordable, lightweight, and packable tool, I can't talk tonight, for building a snow shelter. Folks, you actually build your own igloo. It's a perfect tool to do so. Our good friend Igloo Ed, who lives on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park, what he actually does is goes up into the mountains in early winter, builds the igloo, and they go camping throughout the winter. What a great... Some of these igloos will sleep eight people. You need to go to the website. It's www.grandshelters.com. Also, the iKids Fishing Show. That website, iKidsFishing.com, is the first kids fishing show in the USA, starring kids, teaching kids how to fish. 40 million fishermen spending $45 billion a year. The iKids Fishing Show is definitely a keeper. More info at We Want You Cottages at Chautauqua Lake in Western New York. That website is www.wewanchu.com, one of America's finest fishing resorts. And also our good friend Jerry Jones at Tire Service Plus, taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep our animal truck on the road, traveling thousands of miles with our wild animal ambassadors. That number is 317-243-0700. And if you would like to become an individual underwriter, you can do so. Just go to the website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, click Contact, send us a message. We'll tell you what that's all about, and you'll be able to hear your name each week on this program and help keep Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. And we want to remind everyone that next week on the show, another great program plan, Tony Kay from the band Yes will be joining us, the great keyboard player. And we're going to be talking a little rock and roll. Well, I don't know if you really call Yes rock and roll, but should be a fantastic hour, so we hope you join us that evening as well. Our guest tonight from Grays River, Washington, and we were discussing the weather, Robert, and you said you guys have had a rather mild winter. Our guest tonight, Robert Michael Pyle.
Yes, Larry, Tia and I are enjoying an early spring here in the Northwest with irises in bloom already, lots of snowdrops, and the first wildflower, which is the catkins of the wild hazels. So it's very, very pleasant out here, which is a good thing, and yet, of course, it does herald a changing climate. And one thing I noticed on the butterfly trip is that some species benefit and others don't. I mean, we're going to be seeing some species changing their range to the degree that we won't have them around anymore, while others move in from the south. So it's a give-and-take deal. Hey, by the way, I wanted to congratulate you and Cheryl on your new book.
Oh, well, thank you.
And do give our regards to her.
I certainly will. He's talking about Alphabet Swamp. That was a lot of work.
I bet it was a lot of work. Books are a lot of work. And, you know, the fun part's being out in the field and gathering the information and then have it. Enjoying the pleasure of others in enjoying your books. But the actual production of the creature itself is a lot of work, no question.
And I've always told people, we've had done several book signings, and I know you've done hundreds. Well, what a feeling it is for someone to walk off with a book that you've just signed that you put so much hard work in. There's not a feeling quite like it, is there, Robert?
There isn't. No, you're quite right. And the selling of books is... I mean, the entire book business is a very strange and weird business. It hardly merits that name sometimes, I think. Business, that is. However, that's the best part of it, is walking away with your book, or the letters you get afterwards, or phone calls or emails that tell you that that book actually affected someone. You know, that brings us nicely into Bigfoot, because publishing is changing so fast, and I'm extremely fond of the actual physical object of the book, I have to say. I mean, any way anybody reads text, that's fine with me. I've got nothing against new tools. And yet, there's something about the book itself which gives me great pleasure. We just had a big all-wall bookcase built in our studio that has enabled me to finally get books out of boxes and get everything up to where I can find it, you know. And there's such a pleasure in handling them as an object and then taking them down and renewing your acquaintance with them. But in trying to get paper books published today, it's changing very, very fast, Larry. So since you and I last talked, my book, Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide, has gone out of print from Houghton Mifflin Company. That happened with a lot of other books. Right after it was announced that e-book sales had exceeded the sales of trade paperbacks for the first time.
Oh.
And as soon as that happened, my brand new book ended up having a decision that it would not even have a paperback edition. And Where Bigfoot Walks and a couple of other books went out of print. So that puts the author in the position of curator to try to get those books out into print again. And that's where I am. In case anybody's wondering there on the air, what's happening with Where Bigfoot Walks, right now it's out of print, and I'm working hard with a couple of publishers to try to get it back into print. The hope is that Sasquatch Books in Seattle, which is a very good publisher, they're the publisher of my book Wintergreen in this current edition, and of course they're the most appropriate publisher with that name, Sasquatch.
Right.
We're hoping they're going to bring it back into print.
I just don't see a book in a newspaper. I don't think computers can replace that.
It's a different kind of experience, and for some people, a lot of the young in particular, whose primary reading experience is on screen, it doesn't seem to make any difference. But and then a lot of people are, of course, seduced by the novelty of their e-book readers. But I've heard from a number of people now who have got their Kindles and they've got their thousands of titles online and in their discs and so on and on their hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going back, not totally, but at least in part, to paper books because they enjoy the tactility and the smell and the feel of the book itself. So I'm very much hoping it won't become extinct. You know, you talked about Yes coming on the show, which is very exciting, or the keyboardist from Yes. People are going back to vinyl to some extent. There are a number of artists who are releasing their new releases now, as Leonard Cohen just did, on vinyl as well as CD as well as online. So,
well,
the old forms have their merit, and we can hope that they will be preserved.
Well, our good friend who's been on the show several times, Shelley Leibowitz, the Hollywood producer who has the record company,
right?
He is getting ready to release a whole bunch of vinyl because he owns this library of fantastic old blues artists.
Oh, good for him.
And it's going to work out well because not only is he a music producer, but he's also now a film producer. And he is doing the film with Snoop Dogg on the legendary blues artist Fillmore Slim.
I'll be darned.
So the man has got it going because this movie's going to come out. It's probably going to be a big deal. It's going to introduce a lot of these youngsters to the blues. And Harry's going to be putting out this series of new recordings from old artists. And vinyl is coming back. It makes me sick because I threw away so many albums. I don't want to say, but anyway.
Or you can build it back up again.
Yeah, absolutely. Your travels this summer, did you run into any new information about in your interest in Bigfoot as you travel?
Not in those particular travels. However, just recently, it's interesting. I can't name any names right now because it's confidential, but I had a call the other day from a person I very much trust and respect. I think he's one of the most humble, which is not a common trait in the Bigfoot world, but one of the most reliable and just an individual I deeply admire. On the next show, this might become public and we can name him.
Mm-hmm.
But he let me know on a confidential basis that a couple of hunters brought in the body parts and there's some DNA analysis going on right now. Now, having said that,
mm-hmm.
let me say this too. We've heard this 1,000 times, and we've heard 1,000,000 times about hunters bringing in parts and being coy about the source and so on and so forth.
Right.
What I'd like to know is if this really does happen, and I asked my friend this, if this is for real, and of course, I think listeners who know my book will know my ethical stance on this. I used to argue with Grover Krantz. Grover Krantz used to say, the first person that shoots a Bigfoot should get a medal and the next one should go to jail. You know, he thought we have to establish the existence in order to conserve them.
Right.
I found that an interesting argument, but ethically a little bit slippery. I would like to see a DNA sample that's irrefutable, but I'd far prefer it to come from something other than a direct human lethality, you know, actually killing the animal that may be closest to us of all in evolutionary terms.
Mm-hmm.
But so I say all this with those reservations. But if, in fact, somebody actually did shoot and kill an animal, why in the world wouldn't they bring in, as Grover used to recommend, the largest part that they were capable of removing? This is a bit gory, and I hate the imagery of it. But, you know, if you actually made that error or that calculated decision,
mm-hmm.
And had the carcass before you,
right?
Why in the world then does it become a case of, well, there's a little piece of flesh with some blood, and we might get DNA from it, and so on. Why in the world isn't there a hand, or heaven help us, a foot? You know.
All right.
I mean, I'm not advocating this, but I am saying that we hear these stories, and they're like my friend's very excited that he thinks something will re-come of this. But I have to say, I'm withholding judgment because there always seems to be this logical gap in the story.
Well,
so I don't know. We'll see. But that's the most recent thing I've heard, that there may in fact be at a reputable laboratory right now a sample, a specimen that may in fact yield that evasive DNA sample that everyone's been wondering about.
Well, and you know what'll probably happen, depending on how much of whatever they brought in they did absolutely turn in. Like they've done with hair samples that have been analyzed by various scientists, they'll come up with an unknown primate.
Exactly. I expect that's probably exactly where they'll do. And that's,
mm-hmm.
that's why a flesh plug might not be... Peter Byrne used to try with his Forest Service permits and colleagues, or not colleagues, but collaborators with the Forest Service. They had stations with trip wires and light-activated plug guns that were not going to hurt the animal but take a flesh plug. And a flesh plug might not work for just that very reason. I'm afraid that, you know, I've often thought, Larry, that
mm-hmm.
I spent time hiking in the Valley of 10,000 Smokes in Katmai National Park in Alaska, which may be the wildest place I've ever been in my life. And those tufa or ash deposits erode down quickly, and they form these multicolored canyons like a miniature Grand Canyon after the giant ash explosions of volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happening right now at Mount St. Helens at the National Volcanic Monument. The fact is that Mount St. Helens is the center of abundance of Bigfoot reports over the past 200 years.
Right.
And it would surprise me, frankly, if there wasn't significant Bigfoot mortality from the Mount St. Helens eruption. And I would think that the possibility is not remote that a careful looking at the recent ash flow canyons there could be a very good place to try to find some fossils of actual bones. And that's something that's a lot less equivocal than merely a flesh blood.
Well, and it makes absolutely more sense. I do not trust hunters. Anything they shoot, they want to brag about it. Whether they have
it
hanging on their wall.
It's like a big fish story.
Right. And I still don't believe these stories. Well, they've killed one, they've kept it quiet. No. Because if anyone does do that with that mindset of hunting, they're going to want to brag about their conquest.
Exactly. I think in many, many cases they're trying to purvey something else into something it's not and see how far they can take it. And so that may well happen with this one, too. It reminds me of the old stories from Happy Camp in California, well before the Patterson-Gimlin film of Ray Wallace and his road crew up there, you know, and Ray claimed for a long time that he'd caught one all right, and he had it in a container, and he fed it Frosted Flakes, but he had to have some money from the researchers to buy more Frosted Flakes, and how about a little more money? Then I'll show it to you eventually. You know.
No.
Hey, by the way, Larry, I did have an actual, real, truly exciting experience since I've last talked to you.
Really?
Do we have a moment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Me to share this?
Please.
You'll recall from my book, Where Bigfoot Walks, that toward the end of the book, toward the end of the time, my month in the Dark Divide, unprotected wild area in Washington, that I had a dramatic auditory experience, which when I followed it up by daylight, had originated in a spot that that now, when I went back, was graced with 12 big footprints, two of which were crisp enough to get pretty good pictures of that are in the book. And they were right at the average size and proportions that are in the mean and the median in the Bigfoot Research Project's database. Well, that was pretty exciting. Kept my mind open at the end of that whole project. You may recall me telling you also that 9 years after that, I went back with the Japanese film crew that made a pretty good Bigfoot film based on my book. They were inspired by that, and I got them together with Larry Lund and various other people. They went out in the forest. I took them out and told them, we're not going to find anything. You don't find anything when you're looking. But I showed them the territory, showed them the country, showed them a few things that the Klickitat Indians say Bigfoot does this and does that. And on our way out, lo and behold, we did almost step on a track that was crisp in the volcanic ash. This was only about 300 yards from my previous set of tracks, had the very same proportions 9 years later, so it spoke of possibly the same animal. Well, now come forward. Since you and I have last talked, just two summers ago, I was up in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest again, in the very same area near Elk Pass, east of Mount St. Helens. I was walking on a logging road that I'd not been on before. Now I'm about a quarter mile from the original site, maybe a half mile from that second site, 10 years later again. And on the hillside to my left, on the angle of repose, again in Mount St. Helens ash, but a little more solid this time, more lithified, is a set of tracks moving up the slope, not particularly crisp because they'd broken through the crust and into the ash. And what I found is, as I followed that set of tracks, was that there was a horizon along that slope, an erosional difference of a different hardness of deposit. And along that horizon, there was a series of ground squirrel nests right into the slope at that same latitude.
Mm-hmm.
Well, from time to time along that slope, these footprints were mirrored by handprints where the animal had clearly lunged at the ground squirrel holes. Well, that was interesting enough, but then I noticed that there was a pair of miniature tracks going alongside the large tracks. And I believe what I may well have found were tracks of an adult and tracks of a juvenile who was being trained in the practice of hunting ground squirrels. And they went all along that horizon, right up the slope, the angle of repose, up to the hard, mossy forest edge and on up into the firs.
Mm-hmm.
The size of those tracks, once again, the most measurable, best track, was just the same as the tracks from two different locations within a half a mile of that same location over the past 20 years. So we may, in fact, be seeing the same individual on a home range with young. And I found that not only exciting, not only did it keep my mind open once again, but it renewed my interest in the entire topic.
Oh, that would do it. Absolutely, that would do that.
You know, we need things like that, Larry. You do it in your work every day, which is laborious and devoted to these creatures we share the world with. You need something to keep you fresh, don't you?
Oh, you do. Something to inspire you to.
That's it.
Fresh. New. And oh, I know exactly what you're saying. I understand that completely.
You clean out those pens and you write those books and you communicate and you have your magnificent Blogspot radio program and you talk to the widest array of interesting people. That must be a great reward in your work.
Oh,
from time to time, you need an experience out there in the field with those creatures themselves that lets you know that the world is alive and living and way beyond our understanding, and it still produces surprise.
Well, it does, and I believe now with the youngsters and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife are so concerned because the youngsters don't get out like they used to.
Exactly.
They're hypnotized by their computer screen, their video games, and they are concerned whether they're going to have enough biologists and zoologists and naturalists like yourself to do the very important work that groups like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have to do.
Well, and like yourself, and let us not get away from this important topic without mentioning the guru of this field now, Richard Louv, with his wonderful book, Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. And he's got a new book out now to follow that up called The Nature Principle. And in that book, he talks about what he calls vitamin N and how we all need a daily dose of vitamin N for nature. I just got a message from his group today, by the way, and by the way, I'll recommend this to anybody if they're interested in this entire question of connecting the young with the outdoors and the natural world in this age of, I mean, my kids, my grandkids are crazy on Lego, and Lego is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's physical. You use your hands. It's not strictly on a screen, although it has its screen counterparts too, but it's still not outdoors. And, everyone who's concerned about this whole question of nature deficit disorder, you might want to check out a group called CNN. It's not CNN, the news group. It's Children and Nature Network. It's well worth looking at. I recommend you, everyone does that, but one thing Richard has found is that the children's books that are being published today, far fewer of them appertain to wildlife and the outdoors. So that's something to be concerned about as well.
Well, we need to invite him on the show sometime. What a great hour.
I really think you should, Larry. I'll send you his details.
Oh, please do. Yeah, that would be a fantastic hour.
Richard would be a splendid presence on your show.
Oh, my Lord. Well, you've been fantastic as always. This hour has flown by, Robert.
Tends to do that, doesn't it?
Oh, my Lord. And as I've mentioned before, I enjoyed that week so much at the National Conservation Training Center with the young college students. We had such a great time.
We had a really good time, and that was an example of how when kids get together and share a common concern for the world, and we got them outdoors. Remember, we had them out of that campfire. It was hot, and there were chiggers and mosquitoes, but you had them absolutely spellbound about Bigfoot stories. And they forgot about the chiggers. They forgot about the heat. And they were out of doors, and they loved it. So kids retain the desire to do so.
Well,
we just have to inspire it.
That's right, yes. And that's our job. From the remaining days on this planet, that's your job, my job, and all the other people that love the natural world as much as we do.
Amen.
Yeah, that's right. What a fantastic hour. Great show, Dr. Day.
Oh, yes, Mr. Pyle is always entertaining and educational.
Well, you should talk, Dr. Day. It was a pleasure to hear you.
And I think on the next butterfly safari, we should get our nets and go with him.
I would love to do that. That would be fantastic.
I wish you would do that.
We'll do
it. I'll issue you an invitation.
Well, thank you. We want to remind everyone that next week on the program, as I had mentioned earlier, Tony Kaye from the classic rock band Yes will be with us. We're going to hear a little bit about what he's involved with and also some great stories from the past, our guest tonight. And we love him. He did such a wonderful job, Robert Michael Pyle. Thank you
very much. Thanks for having
me again, Larry. Oh, it was great.
Thank you so much.
And we want to thank all our listeners around the world. We will talk to you next week. And don't forget to tell your friends, you can download this show absolutely free of charge from now on to forever in all of our past episodes. So please go to blogtalkradio.com, Larry Batson's Wild World. Have a great week, everyone. We'll talk to you next week on Wild World. Good night.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.